Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. We're glad for the opportunity to get together once again, and I'm especially excited about today's program as we talk particularly about leadership and maybe some things that the leaders can and should do to protect and guard their time and their talents. We have an opportunity to discuss the view from the top. In fact, View from the Top is the title of a new book. The subtitle is An Inside Look at How People in Power See and Shape the World. You know, in our country, there's only a few thousand individuals that make the decisions that influence the lives of over 300 million. And we're going to find out about those decision makers and some principles that we can draw from. Michael Lindsay is the author of this study. It was a large and significant study. He's the president of Gordon College, one of the youngest college presidents in the country, award-winning sociologist and educator. He has spent, I think it's about 10 years putting this study together, and out of it comes the findings in the book View from the Top. And so, Dr. Lindsay, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks very much, Neil. Great to be with you.
You know, if it's true that, you know, there are just a few thousand individuals that really influence the rest of the nation, I mean, is it? I know you quoted in your book, someone said that organizations are just webs of relationships. That's all they are. I mean, is this really about a small group of people that are pretty interconnected?
You know, I went into this project thinking that individuals are the key to how power works in our society. And I had a chance to sit down with some of the most influential Americans alive, 550 senior leaders, titans of industry, including 250 CEOs, the heads of organizations like Walmart, AT&T, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, as well as former Presidents Carter and Bush, cabinet secretaries like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, as well as the head of hundreds of nonprofit organizations, some of the biggest ones around, like the American Red Cross, the Boy Scouts of America, and the American Cancer Society, as well as the presidents of major universities, like the presidents of Harvard and Stanford, Princeton, and Duke. Over the course of that study, however, I became convinced that while individuals do make a difference, the real power in our society occurs through institutions. And so the book tries to describe how it is that individual leaders begin to shape institutional cultures and how those institutions, in turn, get things done in our world.
At the time, you were at Rice University. You're now president of Gordon. I mean, I'm sure there were probably a few things that you could apply immediately kind of in your transition to this new position.
Yeah, it was wonderful. In the middle of doing this research project, I moved from being the researcher to the practitioner. And I was able to get sort of a graduate degree in leadership and life by these 550 interviews I completed. And there have been multiple times when I've turned back to thinking about the stories of the individuals. And frankly, I developed friendships with them. So I've called some of them for counsel. It's been really helpful as I've tried to serve and lead at Gordon with both grace and truth.
I do get that impression that as you talk about in the book, that there is that idea of calling others that are that know their way around, that it's not just about having a college or university or, you know, graduate education. It's actually about getting connecting with the people that know how to fix and solve things, right?
That's right. A lot of what takes place in our culture requires people in different sectors working together. So in my own work as Gordon's president, I find that I have to pick up the phone and give a call to a friend or an associate to ask them to be helpful to us. And in turn, I get phone calls all the time. And one of the great opportunities as a leader is that you're able to use whatever respective sphere of influence you have to try and help advance the common good.
Is it possible to sort of break into those kind of networks? I mean, you know, you're working in a college setting. You know, we try and encourage graduates. You know, you need to get your name out there. You need a network. But, I mean, how do we actually get to some of those, connect with some of the people at the very top?
One of the key things that we found is that the college years and early career are the key moments where young people who are talented or bright are really given the chance to move up into senior positions of responsibility. So I tell the Gordon students whenever we have a guest speaker come to town that they ought to go and shake the hands of that person at the end of the talk, try and get their business card, and then send a handwritten note after the meeting. I find that we're a culture that no longer has a lot of folks who are writing letters by hand, and so it really stands out. And that begins the journey of a relationship for these young people. And I found there have been a number of examples of Gordon students who have connected with a guest speaker, and that in turn creates opportunities for internships, summer jobs, and sometimes professional references.
But speaking of college students, I know that you discuss in the book that leadership begins at 20. So say a word about why is that age so important and how things change?
This is one of the biggest surprises, Neil, of the whole research. We found that there's actually very little that leaders do before age 20 that increases their likelihood to rise to senior positions. It doesn't matter if you were born into a family with a lot of money or not very much. It doesn't matter if you were a high school athlete, student body president, a nerd, introvert, somebody who's outgoing or not very well connected. None of those variables really matter until you reach your mid-college years. And then it matters a great deal what you do between ages 20 and 40. After you've reached age 40, most people sort of at that point view you as no longer somebody they ought to invest in or help nurture, and so you're sort of on your own. But between 20 and 40 is when we find a professional mentor who helps us make the right connections. It's when we're given our first big break, whether it's a big responsibility or a chance to apply for a competitive fellowship, and that in turn puts us in a different course, different trajectory.
You know, you talk about becoming leaders and people of influence. Are there factors, though? I mean, you discovered a few interesting things. I mean, the self-made leader is kind of a myth, isn't it?
It is. We found that the idea that you sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps just doesn't bear weight in empirical reality. Most of the time, individuals, whether they were born into a family with lots of connections or not many, found that they had to build relationships, and that's what allowed them to get an early start. For example, George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States, was born into a wealthy family, had a lot of good opportunities, went to Yale for undergrad, and had a privileged background. But his political career really began as he and Barbara began sending Christmas cards to lots of people. By the time he decided to run for office, they were sending 10,000 Christmas cards a year. Now, that's a huge operation, and not everybody can take that on. But what you find is that it's not so much about the money as much as it is about the relationships. And that's something that all of us can take advantage of. So I tell our students, it's really important to make friends over social media like Facebook, having connections through LinkedIn, but it's also really important for you to stay in touch with those relationships. People move from time to time, and as we move, sometimes we lose connections with those friends, those neighbors, those colleagues that we once worked with. The people who really succeed are folks who are able to keep those connections alive and well, even as they expand their network.
So are there some disadvantages or some challenges for people that want to pursue leadership at a high level? I mean, maybe it's living in a rural location or maybe even a minority or some of those things. Talk about maybe some of the barriers that might be there.
Well, there certainly are a lot of cultural barriers. We don't have nearly as many women in leadership as we have women in our general population. We don't have as many folks, people of color, in positions of leadership. And so there are strategic things that we need to be doing to create more opportunities. But probably the wider challenge that I think that we face is that we live in a day and age when social media can be quite cruel, when the expectations for leaders require them to be superhuman, and where the demands of their time erode their ability to have a sustainable, nurturing family life. And if there's anything that we know over the long haul, the leader needs to be able to have margin in his or her life and to be able to nurture those family relationships and close friendships. So we've got to do a better job in our culture of giving our leaders the benefit of the doubt and encouraging people of real honor and integrity to seek out positions of responsibility. There's a notion within the faith community that maybe we ought not to have believers in positions of leadership. I completely disagree with that, because if we don't have thoughtful people of faith in positions of responsibility in our culture, then we're going to have all the leadership positions occupied by people who don't understand the kind of ethical and moral grounding that you can get from a deep and vibrant faith. But that's probably, in my opinion, one of the greatest perils and one of the most important things that we need to do to try and help our young people have what John Stott would describe as holy ambition, ambition for the right kinds of things, not personal accomplishment or personal pride, but instead a deep sense of responsibility for making a positive difference in the world.
Well, I know you've addressed that in one of your award-winning books, Faith in the Halls of Power, that there the good news, I guess, is that there is a growing number of men and women of faith that are moving into these positions and having some influence, right?
That's right. When I wrote Faith in the Halls of Power, I have to say I was incredibly encouraged by the generation of young and emerging leaders who were well-educated, thoughtful, intentionally committed to their faith, who also wanted to try and make a difference in major institutions. We are a culture that's dominated by big institutions, and so I oftentimes tell my college students that early in their career, it doesn't have to be their first job, but within their first 5 years, I really encourage them to spend time living in a major global center of commerce, whether that be New York or Los Angeles or London or Hong Kong. Have some experience of being in those kind of places. Get involved in a faith community there because that will help nourish and encourage them, but also they can be salt and light in a very important environment. I also think it's really important that young people take a job working for a major institution because those are the organizations that have disproportionate sway on how our culture goes.
We're going to talk more about that and more from Dr. Michael Lindsay's book called View from the Top, an inside look at how people in power see and shape the world. Michael Lindsay is a president of Gordon College and talking with us today on Connecting Faith. We'll continue in just a moment. Listening to Connecting Faith, we've connected with Michael Lindsay today, who's authored the findings of a 10-year study, a significant study of interviewing over 500 businessmen and women and over, I think, a 10-year period. It's called View from the Top, an inside look at how people in power see and shape the world, because the fact is that there are people in power that have exponential influence, I guess, over that. And we want to get into talk about some of those important areas, some of the challenges in terms of maybe family and relationships. But I am interested in maybe talking a bit about leadership mastery. And I think, you know, we assume that it's productivity and ability to motivate. What did you find out about some of these key leaders? What did they have that maybe others don't?
Well, one of the interesting ways that leaders are able to get things done is they figure out how to master their time. All of us are given 24 hours a day, and some folks are able to make better use of it than others. The really impressive leaders, the ones that we call in the book platinum leaders, were folks who had figured out how not to be dominated in their lives by email. They created structures in their life so that maybe they spend an hour or 2 hours working through the hundreds of emails they get in a given day, but then they're able to put it aside and deal with other projects. They're able to figure out how to maximize meeting times. One of the great stories came from John Whitehead, who served as the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Every day, he would hold 4 15-minute meetings with different groups of folks at the firm. So each meeting was only 15 minutes altogether. It was an hour of his day. He spent every day meeting with different groups. He called these standing meetings. That's because everybody remained standing for the whole meeting. He said it's amazing how efficient people can be when they're not sitting down. And over the course of this 15 minutes, he could sort of ask a couple of key questions, get some feedback from various folks, and then have a sense of what's happening in that part of the business. That was one way that he was able to stay connected on a daily basis and get a lot of things done in a short amount of time. Virtually every impressive leader that I met had figured out some tip or trick like that that allowed them to be able to master their time. One very practical tip that I picked up that's been helpful for me is one leader I interviewed had a separate manila file folder for every single day of the year. So one for January 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way through December 31st. And whenever he got a piece of mail or an activity or responsibility of something he needed as a tickler file on a certain day, he would just file it under that date and keep a running list of those regular reminders. Some folks have figured out how to do this on their calendar program, on the computer, or on their smartphone. But one way or another, they figure out a system where they can keep track of important information that's going to happen at some point in time in the future. Everybody has their own system, but I found that over the course of this 10 years of study, I found that those who are great leaders had figured out a way to master their time.
Talking about View from the Top, an inside look at how people in power see and shape the world. We have to probably talk about leaders in the midst of crisis, because those crucible times are where the real character comes out. What sort of observations, lessons did you learn, and maybe even, you know, from your own perspective, have had a share of some of those challenges as well?
Well, I had a tremendous opportunity to interview four or five people who had very important positions around 9/11. I interviewed Condoleezza Rice, who was National Security Advisor, Andy Card, who was White House Chief of Staff, Gerard Arpey, who was the CEO of American Airlines, Andy Rosenthal, who was the editor of the New York Times, Brenda Berkman, who was the first female firefighter in New York City and was on duty on 9/11. And they each had different perspectives of how they handled that particular day's events and how it shaped their understanding of leadership. One of the key things that I walked away from this study is that crisis really doesn't develop character as much as it does reveal it. That I think a lot of us just assume that when you're in the crucible of crisis, that somehow the experience will shape your character in a profound way. In my own journey as a leader, I have found that whenever there are crisis moments that come up, I'm really having to just simply respond in the moment. I don't have a lot of time for reflection. It's more instinctive responses. And that's why I say to our students at Gordon, character is something you develop over a lifetime and draw upon in moments of crisis.
What do we do when what's right and true and no longer rules the day? I mean, how do top-level leaders overcome maybe attacks and distortions? I mean, you talked about some of the challenges of social media, and I mean, we have high expectations, but we're also pretty quick to criticize.
I will say that this project has convinced me that whether I agree with the person who's in the White House or not, or agree with their senior staff, I'm never going to personally criticize the folks who are working in the White House. It's an incredibly demanding job. These folks work incredibly long hours with, you know, relatively little reward. It's very challenging. I think that frankly, the faith community needs to do a better job of modeling for the rest of the world how we can be true to our core convictions, but also demonstrate grace. The Gospel of John describes Jesus as being full of both grace and truth. And the order of those words was very important to the gospel writer, and I think it should be very important for people of faith, whatever their tradition, in trying to let that come forth. And it's my hope that in my better moments, I've been able to do that. And in the moments when I fall short, I have friends who help hold me accountable.
You know, there are men and women of influence in our society, and I'm just wondering, you know, when their moral compass isn't necessarily pointing in the right direction, when the, you know, truth is not what we would certainly call it, that has important ramifications, doesn't it? Because they're influencers over hundreds, thousands, millions of people, perhaps.
Some of the most important decisions are made by small groups of people, decisions that have a profound effect on our culture and our society. I had a chance to ask Condoleezza Rice what was the most poignant moment during her 8 years working in the White House as National Security Advisor and as Secretary of State. And I was struck by how she told the story of a particular meeting of what they called White House principals, individuals who were senior leaders, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and they were considering a policy decision related to AIDS relief across Africa in a program called PEPFAR. And in the end of the day, Dr. Rice had a chance to talk about her own personal story of her mom's battle with cancer and how it had been so meaningful that her mom was able to live for 15 years longer than expected, during which time Condoleezza Rice graduated from high school, went to college, finished college, entered graduate school, and got her first job as a faculty member at Stanford, and how profound that was for her mom to be able to experience that. Because Condoleezza Rice had that journey, and because she was in the room where the decision was made, she was able to draw upon that experience that in the end affected thousands, hundreds of thousands of people across the African continent. One of the key lessons that I walked away from this study is that if we want more people of faith to actually be able to exert influence, they've got to be in the room when decisions are made.
And that means that we have to go about, I guess, being intentional, right? I mean, I know there is something called accumulated advantage, but we have to be about the business of accumulating, don't we?
That's right. And one of my core convictions is that, certainly from my tradition as an evangelical Christian, is that this is not about us grabbing more power or trying to somehow exert influence in a Machiavellian or a worldly way. I simply think that it's a matter of being a good steward. Probably there's never been a cohort of committed Christians who have been more blessed than those who live in North America in 2014. And because we have been blessed, there's an expectation for us to bless other people. We are blessed to be a blessing. And so when I'm talking with the students at Gordon or other folks, I try to just remind them we have a real responsibility to take the gifts, the opportunities, and the privileges that we've been given and to do good with it, to seek the right opportunities so that we can bear witness to our faith and in the process advance not only the gospel but also the common good.
Michael, say a word to leaders at whatever level they might be in about, you know, some of the pitfalls. I mean, you talk about the toll it takes on family and maybe just something as simple as the need for sleep.
Well, I did find that there are a lot of folks out there who are leading major institutions who are trying to get by with 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I think it's important for us to practice Sabbath rest. There's a reason why that's a biblical injunction. It is a way of harnessing ambition, of saying that this is not about me getting everything done, that I'm responsible for what I can do and nothing more. And so having regular practices of both rest, worship, and ceasing from work, I think also has a way of helping to redirect our ambition in a positive, productive way. Another thing that I think is important is that as folks aspire for positions of responsibility or greater leadership, it's really important that we have a spouse or a close friend who can hold us accountable. We all have deeply held values and beliefs. But when you're in the busyness of a demanding job, it's easy to forget some of those overarching principles. It's easy to forget how hard it is to stay connected to a local house of worship. I can't tell you how many of the leaders I interviewed who are committed Christians who were not really involved in their local churches, or folks who had very good intentions, but they were not actually living out their faith in a way in which they treated their executive assistant, or how they interacted with folks who criticized them. There's a lot in the Bible that teaches us about how we ought to respond in those contexts, and spouses have a way of keeping us humble and reminding us of those deeper values. I found that that's a wonderful antidote to some of the corrosive effects that we might experience in those positions of responsibility and leadership.
It's a fascinating study. It's an extensive study. It took 10 years, the largest ever interview-based study of senior organizational leaders, and it's summed up nicely in the book View from the Top, an inside look at how people in power see and shape the world. Michael Lindsay has put it together. He's an award-winning sociologist and educator, and now Dr. Lindsay serves as president at Gordon College, and we're honored to spend some time talking with him today. Dr. Lindsay, thank you for this great research and your time today.
Thanks very much, Neil. Great to be with you.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we invite you to stay tuned for more as we spend a little time talking about how to simplify with Bill Hybels. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Coming up next, an important discussion on finding balance in our life. We turn to Chris Fabry, talking with Bill Hybels about his new book, Simplify.
We all have at times when life can get busy, but
when you do find yourself overwhelmed, overscheduled, or exhausted, what do you do? What's your antidote?
Today, best-selling author Bill Hybels shares personal stories and ideas from his new book, Simplify, 10 Practices to Unclutter Your Soul. and talks about how we can take a God-first approach for simplifying our busy lives.
There was a time that we could each recall in our lives when we were filled up. That was awesome, wasn't it? So it can be done, right?
You see the warning signs in your life, don't you? Impatience, a short temper, frustration, unkindness, anger. What do you do when your tank is nearing empty? Coming up, a look at how we can go from exhausted to energized, from dissatisfied to fulfilled in every aspect of our lives. And it all begins and ends with our relationship with God and creating a simple sacred place, some room, to meet with Him every day. Welcome to the Simplify Radio Special. Today, Chris Fabry talks with Bill Hybels, senior pastor of Willow Creek Community Church and author of the new book, Simplify, 10 Practices to Unclutter Your Soul. When we are running on empty and feeling overwhelmed, overscheduled, and exhausted, our lives and our emotions can quickly spiral out of control, as Bill Hybels can attest. Now is a good time to find ways to replenish and reorganize ourselves before we hit bottom. Here now are Chris Fabry and his special guest, Bill Hybels.
Bill Hybels, welcome to the program. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Glad to be with you, Chris.
As you work with leaders here and abroad, you're hearing people talk about the burnout that comes, the stress, the dissatisfaction in life. Is that really why you wrote this?
Yeah, I think I got to a certain point where certain words were just being used so often that I started to remember them in a list, you know, in my mind. People kept using words like, I'm exhausted, I'm overwhelmed, I'm overscheduled, I'm anxious, I'm dissatisfied. And when you hear those words as many times as I heard them, not just in the U.S., but in various countries and cultures around the world, I thought, there's a pattern developing here. There's an epidemic of some sort that has to be addressed.
So simplified living, can you define that for us? This is not a magic formula, is it?
No, but I'll tell you what my primary concern became, and that is I think we've gotten to a point where it's sort of a badge of honor to be harried, to be maxed out, to be jet lagged, and we sort of brag about it. It's not that we're ashamed of it and feel like, oh, this is a terrible thing I have to get over. We walk around and say this at parties or say this at church or say this at work to prove a sense of self-worth. And we know at a deeper level this is insane and it's certainly unsustainable. So when I heard enough of this, saw enough of it in my own life, I thought, you know, simplify is kind of the main concept, but I think of it along the lines of streamlining. It's choosing to focus our limited energies on what matters most, and then it's strategic neglect. It's deciding, you know what, I'm not going to chase that. I'm not going to get overly concerned about that other thing. I don't have to get a straight A in that category. So it's both streamlining and strategic neglect that has to come into focus, I think, if we're going to make some progress on this.
And there is a biblical precedent for this, and you see it all throughout the scriptures, but particularly in the life of Jesus and a couple of his friends.
Yeah, that near the beginning of the book, I referenced the point where Jesus and the disciples show up at Mary and Martha's house, and Mary's just content to hang out. She greets Jesus and the disciples and just wants to converse, which is, from what we can gather from the text, what Jesus really wanted to do most, too, is just fellowship with both sisters. And yet Martha gets all revved up and gets angry with her sister, actually gets angry with Jesus, too, and almost confronts Jesus about her, you know, lazy sister and why she's not doing the work and so on. And Jesus said those famous words, you're worried and upset about so many things. And to me, I've studied that passage many times. He's saying, you know, if you think I came for a feast, you know, I just fed 5,000 people. I could have created a feast here. No worries. I actually came for fellowship. Your sister's getting that right. So let's amp down a little bit and actually do what I came here most to do. But that little phrase, you know, you're worried and upset about so many things. That's the way many of us live our lives these days, is just so many things.
You know, the other aspect of that, I cannot find it. If you can find it and show me, I'll believe it. But I can't find any place in the scripture, in the Gospels, where it says, and Jesus was in a really big hurry and he, you know, rushed over here. Think of what he had on his mind. Think of all the people around him who had all of these needs. And he seems to be the most peaceful person on the planet.
Yeah, it kind of bugs you, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, he didn't just have a Messiah complex. He was actually the Messiah and was actually trying to redeem the world and did it at a sustainable pace with a peaceful spirit and really trying to get over-revved people around him to settle down a little bit and to think this stuff through. So, yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time before I wrote the book studying the patterns of Jesus. And that's a very humbling thing to do. He had a lot on his plate, you know, the understatement of the year, and did it with a graciousness and without the kind of stress that most of us do his work with.
Yes. And with all of that on his shoulders, and there were times of great sweat drops of blood in the garden, but he lived his life at a different level. And I think that that's part of what you're talking about. And half of the problem is we can't see it in ourselves. We don't understand. We don't see the signs when other people around us can. And you have given a series of sermons on this book, Simplify, at Willow Creek Community Church. You shared a personal experience of running on empty for a long time, too long, and finally hitting bottom. Let's hear that story right now.
I had been depleted many years back, not just for days, not just for weeks. I'd been depleted for months. So much so that one by one, my family sort of suggested to me that maybe I ought to go over by myself to our cottage in South Haven for a few days to kind of freshen myself up, which was code for, Dad, you're over the edge. You're no fun around here. Go inflict yourself on yourself for a few days in another environment. So I packed my duffel bag. I'm walking down our long hallway to the garage. We had a little dog that was alive at the time, and he saw me come and dove into the laundry room, and I thought, the dog knows I'm on edge. I get to South Haven, and I realize the person who used the cottage before me had not thought that the one who pays the bills would be coming over, so there's no food. So I got to go to this little grocery store, and I get a bag of groceries. After I pay the bill, I'm starting to walk toward this little door in this tiny little grocery store, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this wounded Vietnam vet in a wheelchair that I'd seen around town before, and I notice that he's converging toward the exit of that little store at the same time I am, so I calculate his speed, and I remember thinking, are you kidding me? We're going to converge at exactly the same time. He's going to be slow going through that door because he's in the wheelchair, and I got to be courteous and probably help him. And here's the thought. I thought, what else could go wrong today? And in that split second, God took the scales off my eyes, and I looked into the cesspool of resentment and exhaustion and darkness that was my human heart. And I'm not kidding you, when I saw it for what it was, I felt my knees getting weak. I felt like I might vomit right in the store. I helped the guy through the double doors out into the parking lot. And I realized that in that depleted condition, I was more frustrated by the 15 seconds longer little bit of time it was going to take me to exit that store than I was stirred with compassion about the life of that soldier who had served our country and spent 15 years in that wheelchair with his legs all blown up. When I got out of the store and saw that the other guy was on his way, I put the groceries in the back seat of my truck, and I got into the driver's seat. I put my head on the steering wheel and just lost it. And I was asking these kinds of questions. What's happened to me? Who have I become? Am I still a Christian? And then I went into, you know, kind of self-reproach. I hate who I've become. And then I just went, God help me, God help me, God help me. Gang, that was my hitting bottom moment of realizing the price of depletion. I hit bottom in the parking lot of that little store.
Bill, at the beginning of that story, you can hear the audience following along. They're kind of laughing. but at the end, it is silent. Did you sense they were right there with you, that they'd experienced those same feelings?
Well, first of all, I think they were a little bit surprised that I would be that vulnerable to tell that kind of story. That was not my finest moment. And I think in that quietness was, we've all had moments like that or worse. So when I was asking the question, you know, do I like who I've become? I think the quietness in the auditorium at Willow was several thousand people asking the same question. Do I like who I've become?
Yeah. You know, this tyranny of the calendar, this the schedule, this to-do list that we have, I really think this is a microcosm not only of our problem, our stress and struggle physically and emotionally, mentally. It's also a spiritual thing, because we can get on that to-do list of the spiritual check-off thing and I'm okay with God and live our lives that way and come to the end of ourselves, can't we?
Yeah, and I have a chapter in Simplify that takes an entirely counterintuitive look at what a schedule is. Most of us say, oh, I have so much to do that I need a schedule to organize all the things that I have to get done. And I learned throughout the course of my life, maybe a better way of looking at this is, maybe a schedule is a tool for who I want to become. When you look at it that way, you say, what do I want to build into my weekly rhythms, my daily rhythms, weekly rhythms, monthly rhythms, that will up the odds that I will become a better father, or I will become a more devoted spouse, or that I will become a better friend to my friends, or that I'll honor God with my body or with my money or whatever. But if you go at the forming of a schedule with the end game of being who I want to become, you put a different schedule together than if you're just saying, I got to cram all this stuff in. How do I fit it?
Yes. Well, most people live with their schedule ordering their own life. And you're saying, I want to order my life, so I'm going to choose the schedule, the to-do list.
Yeah, and not just that, but I want to try to build a schedule that, I know this sounds a little bit like a cliche, but I want to build a God-first schedule. Like, what would my life look like if God were whispering to me when I put my schedule together? Instead of, who are all these people clamoring for my time and clamoring for, you know, meetings and all this, and letting them be the voice instead of the voice of the Holy Spirit? So I spent a lot of time thinking about how over the years I approach a weekly and monthly and annual calendar or scheduling exercise completely different than I did in my younger years, where all I was trying to do is fill in a bunch of time gaps and organize a bunch of work.
Yes.
And boy, when you see this in a different light, you say, wait a minute, I've got 12 months I'm looking ahead to. Who does God want me to become over the course of the next 12 months? Let's fill in all the stuff that will help me align with that. And surely I've got to get some work done too. So, but his voice helps really on both of those questions.
The Simplify Radio Special, featuring a conversation between Chris Fabry and his special guest, Bill Hybels, the author of the new book called Simplify, 10 Practices to Unclutter Your Soul, published by Tyndale.
Connecting Faith, we're hearing Chris Fabry talk with Bill Hybels about his new book, Simplify. Here's more.
You mentioned the Holy Spirit speaking to you, and there's another moment in your congregation where you told a story when it wasn't necessarily the Holy Spirit alone speaking to you. Your daughter opened your eyes to what was going on in your family and the power of a choice. Let's listen to that, and then I want to hear you respond.
I put schedules together this way all throughout high school, college, during my time in our family business, and even into the early days of the starting of this church, and would probably still be putting schedules together that way, except that a three-year-old little girl named Shauna, who's grown up now, this little girl who had stolen my heart since the day she was born, asked me a single question one night as I was heading out the door. Again, she's 3 years old. I'm headed to another church meeting. She doesn't ask this question out of anger. She asks it out of sheer curiosity. She walks me to the door and she goes, "Daddy, are you going to be gone again tonight?" And with those 9 words, my approach to scheduling came crashing down like a rotted oak tree. I kissed her goodbye at the door. As I'm driving over to the church, I'm thinking, why am I going to be out again tonight? Well, the answer was easy. The meeting was on my schedule. The previous night's meeting was on my schedule. Tomorrow night's meeting was on my schedule. They would have to be important meetings or they wouldn't have made it to my schedule. But I felt a growing tension as I'm driving this car over to the church. I asked myself, how much did I really involve God and prayer and the wisdom of the Holy Spirit when I put my latest schedule together? Or was I just cranking out more work, trying to cram more in? The next morning, I went to a coffee shop, had a fresh piece of paper to work with, and the question that Shauna had asked me the previous night was still frontal in my mind. And so I began by writing this question: what investment of time will it take for me to be a great dad to that precious little girl? And I asked for God's wisdom, and the Holy Spirit seemed to whisper to me, 4 nights a week at home. And I remember for the first time writing on that particular week, home, just like I would an important meeting. Like it had equal stature to the elders meeting, to the board meetings, to the property acquisition meetings, to the fundraising meetings and so. And when I wrote those words on that page, it gripped me fully for the first time, the near supernatural power of a schedule. I thought, hang on, the destiny of a little 3-year-old blonde can change entirely because I'm writing 4 words on a schedule in a time slot that I intend to live out? Really? I can arrange words on a paper that will have generational implications? That was a head-popping moment for me with regard to the power of a commitment on a calendar.
Isn't it amazing how a child who loves her dad can open his eyes and turn your heart around? What did that subtle change to your approach to your schedule do for you and your family?
You know, listening to that clip, I can still remember what she was wearing. I can still see her through the screen door. I had no idea that that was going to become one of the most vivid memories in my life. But I think the very fact that she had no guile, that there was no guilt tripping going on, she was simply curious. What was it that was making her dad leave yet again? She didn't know. And that's what stuck with me when I drove over to the church. I thought, I think I'm getting this all mixed up. And I think I have to look at my time and my schedule more comprehensively. And as I went on in that message and as I go on in the book, I say there's a difference between just organizing your work life and then actually looking at your total life and looking at how family, how relationships, how spiritual practices, physical disciplines, how all of that fits holistically into how we ought to view our time. And if we're ever going to get movement toward that simplified life, when you put all the pieces, on the table to work a new schedule in, that's when both streamlining and what I said earlier about strategic neglect, you get to a point and you go, you know what, that doesn't make the cut anymore. Yes. I can't be worried. I don't have time or space in my head or schedule to be worried about these 4 things anymore. I have to strategically neglect them.
Well, when you do what you're talking about, it makes saying no to something easier because you know why you want to say no. You've decided already or ahead of time, right?
Yeah, 2 things about saying no. Yeah, when you do put a God-first schedule together, you do have a resolve in your spirit to put that schedule together and honor God and figure out who you're going to become and then what you want to get done and all that. But, Chris, you and I both know when we make those hard choices of simplifying our lives, making our lives more sustainable, there are people who feel a little frozen out by that or who get a little cut off from our time or our meetings or whatever. And that's when the guilt flows. And that's like when people who I used to be able to meet with go, "Hey, Bill, now, wait a minute. We used to meet weekly. Now what?" Yeah. You disappoint some people often when you put a new schedule together. And even if it's better for you, it might be hurtful for others.
Tell me about the legacy then of A Simplified Life and personally. Go back to that three-year-old and the question that she asked you at the door. And now fast forward to your life right now. What kind of legacy did those choices leave in her life?
Yeah, well, one of the things I do feel good about at this stage in my life is last week I had my 40th wedding anniversary. So along the way of building a church, you know, I didn't lose a marriage in the process. I have two kids who love God, love our family, love the church. So I didn't estrange any children along the journey. Two little grand boys now who are involved in our church and in our children's ministry, and that we have a very warm, loving, relating pattern with. And, you know, when you get where I am in life, you realize the trade-offs that you made along the way. And if you have a thriving ministry and a broken family or a lot of bodies in ditches that you left behind, then you have some long evenings asking yourself the question, did I make the right choices? I had people in my life who really, really challenged me. One of the reasons I wrote Simplify, because I wanted to sort of collate all of the wisdom that was poured into my life. I wanted to speak very honestly, practically about these issues for readers around the country and around the world who could benefit from some of the lessons I learned from the mentors who faithfully, you know, got into my face.
I have to ask you about the life verse. Why is it important to choose a life verse, and how do you do that?
Yeah, I'm really surprised, Chris, how many Christ followers, serious Christ followers, don't have a life verse. I just sort of assumed that everybody did. And then I decided to do a series about it at Willow. And I gathered three or four other teachers, and we were in a circle one day. And I said, why don't we each do a sermon on our life verses? And they all had a life verse. So I was like, great. So when we started the series, I just said, let's just have a quick hand raise. How many of you have chosen a life verse? Very small percentage of the congregation. And I went, uh-oh, I think I've neglected this. So a life verse is simply a portion of God's word that becomes like a compass in your mind. You choose a life verse because you know what your weaknesses are. You know what you need to stay focused on. A pastor friend of mine, we were having dinner the other day. I said, hey, just out of curiosity, what's your life verse? He said, oh, Matthew 6:33, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of God. And so I interrupted him. I said, why did you choose that one? He said, because everything in me wants to seek everything other than that.
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, that's honest right there. I mean, he said, I need that in my face every day or my compass will pull me off course. And so I do a whole section in the book Simplify about finding a life verse, because I think it helps your focus. It keeps you on the positive side of the equation. You're reminding yourself, why do I get up in the morning? Why do I go through another day here? And keeping your life energy, you know, heading in the right direction is a powerful contributor to a satisfied life.
Bill Hybels, this is going to affect a lot of people. Thank you for spending this time, for working this through in your life, and then telling us about it.
Well, thanks for the call, Chris. I love your ministry, the way that you bring help to people as often as you do. I hope this book will bring some help to people as well.
You've been listening to the Simplify Radio Special, featuring a conversation between Chris Fabry and his special guest, Bill Hybels, senior pastor of Willow Creek Community Church and the author of the new book called Simplify: 10 Practices to Unclutter Your Soul, published by Tyndale. In this book, Bill Hybels points out how to take a God-first approach for radically simplifying our busy lives and replenishing our buckets when they're depleted. Simplify has positive ramifications for all of us in our ministry, our work, our family relationships, and our recreation. John Ortberg, senior pastor of Menlo Park Presbyterian Church, wrote, "No one can truly impact a complex, broken outer world if they do not have a simple, healthy inner world." Bill has navigated exceedingly complex demands for many years. In Simplify, he shares concrete steps into the easy yoke of Jesus, learned in the pressure cooker of real life. You can learn more about Bill Hybels' new book, Simplify, online at simplifybook.com. The Simplify Radio Special is a presentation of Tyndale and was written and produced by Westar Media Group. Thanks for listening.
And this is Connecting Faith. Check out the podcast of today's show at myfaithradio.com.